Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on SEC versus Jarkissi. Our speaker today is Devin Watkins. Devin is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on litigation, government transparency, and regulatory reform. Devin previously worked at the Cato Institute as a legal associate and interned at the Institute for Justice. At the Cato Institute, Watkins worked on a variety of Supreme Court cases, and one of the briefs he worked on was cited by the court. His op-eds have been featured in National Review Online, The Hill, Time, and The Federalist, among others. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker, his full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives his update, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Devin, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
I'm happy to be here. So I'm here to talk about Jarkissi, which, at least in my opinion, is one of the most important Supreme Court decisions in a very long time. There are probably two critically important Supreme Court decisions this term on the size, scope, and power of the administrative state. Of course, the overturning of Chevron has enormous implications for the rulemaking process that all federal agencies go through. But in many ways, Jarkissi is important for the adjudication process is as the overturning of Chevron was for the rulemaking process. This is the other half of agencies' formal powers. So in this case, let me go into a little bit of the kind of factual background. At least according to the ALJs, as found by the SEC, Jarkissi had claimed to brokers and investors that some prominent accounting firm would audit the hedge fund, that some prominent investment bank would serve as the fund's primary broker, and that half the funds would be invested in life insurance policies. The ALJ found that no audit had taken place. No prime brokerage account was open, and only 20% was invested. And so he and the ALJ and the SEC found that Jarkissi had committed securities fraud. Now, I don't know if these facts are true or false, and there was no jury involved in this, despite the fact that Jarkissi had asked for one. The Fifth Circuit reviewed the findings of the SEC and ALJ, and they found that there were three problems with the process that the SEC went through. Specifically, that the SEC had the discretion to bring the case either within federal court or through its administrative process, but that there was no kind of intelligible principle telling the SEC which one it should go for. And so it violated the non-delegation doctrine for the SEC to make that choice without being told by Congress how it should be making that choice. The second problem was that there was a for-cause restriction on the administrative law judge's removal that violated Article 2 in the separation of powers. And lastly, that Jarkissi was entitled to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment. Now, the Supreme Court only decided that third question, specifically on the Seventh Amendment, and left the other two to go back to the Fifth Circuit and the future cases. So those two are still live issues in future cases, but because the Supreme Court was able to resolve it entirely on the Seventh Amendment grounds, that is the entire basis for the Supreme Court's opinion. So I'm going to be focusing on that aspect of it here. So the Seventh Amendment says, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. So the key question then in this case is, what is a suit at common law? According to the SEC, any administrative action brought in its administrative forum is not a suit at common law, because a suit at common law meant in federal court. If you don't go to court, it's not a suit, and therefore it doesn't matter under the Seventh Amendment. We don't need a jury as long as we don't bring it outside of an Article III court. Now, there's some problems with this. If that were actually the case, then Congress could effectively eliminate the Seventh Amendment right and just assign everything to administrative forums or outside courts and just eliminate the right to a trial by jury in all actions. And that seems rather absurd given the history of the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment was created in response to certain abuses by the English government that occurred shortly before the American Revolution. There was a lot of restrictions on trading, specifically that certain goods and ships had to go through, everything had to go through England, had to be bought and sold certain goods through England before it could come to or be sold by the American colonies. This caused prices to go up a lot more than if they had sold directly to foreign governments or foreign individuals. And there was a lot of Americans that were upset by that. And because of that, there was a lot of Americans that committed smuggling and kind of avoided those restrictions. The British government then brought smuggling charges against American colonists. And the American colonists who sat on juries were rather hesitant to convict their fellow American colonists of these crimes. They were very skeptical and kind of really pushed back against a lot of the extravagance in a lot of the prosecutions. And there was a lot of complaints by the British governors that were selected by the English authorities about this. So what the English Parliament decided to do is transfer all of these from English common law courts to admiralty courts that had no jury trials and therefore bypassed the right to a jury and just have individuals that were selected by the British government deciding if these people were guilty and issuing fines. That was the history that then led to the Seventh Amendment that protected these kind of actions and ensured that a jury trial would be allowed. Now, it does say in suits at common law, and at the founding, there was kind of three different areas of law where different cases could be brought. You could bring cases in the common law courts, the courts of equity, and the courts of admiralty. The admiralty courts are for things that occur on the high seas. There's a natural reason to not have a jury in these cases because the actions occurred at the high seas. There is no local jury in the middle of the ocean that you can then call forth to decide issues of fact. Issues of equity was another exception that is distinguished from common law courts. In these cases, you're not trying to punish anyone. You're not taking property from them that they own because they committed some wrongdoing. Instead, you're saying what needs to happen in the future to follow the law. And you're trying to set things right. And because you're not actually punishing anyone, and there's no decision as to some bad act that occurred in the past, the ability for the government to kind of abuse that process, even without a jury, is a lot less, because any decisions made would not generally apply just to the individuals involved, but would then be applicable to anyone in society under equal facts. And so in those cases, admiralty and equity, the founders did not believe that a jury was required, but they did want to preserve it at suits of common law. Now, suits at common law only meant cases brought in court, it could be easily evaded. Instead, at least my opinion is that suits at common law meant suits that at that time would have been brought in common law, meaning that there are suits for damages or to remedy past harms by taking property that people had and giving it to those that were harmed or to the government. Any of these kind of cases were suits at common law. And in those kinds of cases, we need to have a jury trial. And that's mostly what the majority held in this case. one of the key problems is that there are some cases, what's called public rights cases, that where there was no jury involved in the process. Now, a lot of these are cases where even I would not characterize them as suits at common law, although they might involve money. An example might be a federal benefit program. If the government is handing out money and it's not taking money from people that is properly theirs, that the adjudication of that is not a suit at common law. There's no punishment involved in making such a decision. And so though it involves money, it can be done outside of the jury process. There's a variety of other areas that the court identifies, such as certain immigration law, some tax law. For instance, some tax collector is taking money in for the government, and although they take the money in for the government, they then fail to pass it along to the treasury. The government can go and say, look, you use that money to buy the house. We're now going to sell that house and collect the money that is properly ours, the government. We're not just punishing you because of this. We're just trying to take the money that the government already owns. This is our money. And so in those kind of what's called public rights cases, no jury needed to be involved. And those all started perfectly acceptable. Some of these public benefits, some tax cases, stuff like that. There were several of these kind of cases. The problem is that in the 1977 case of Atlas Roofing, the Supreme Court expanded that public rights doctrine to include not just those kind of traditional areas where most people would say that's not a lawsuit at common law, but tried to then claim that anytime the government is exercising sovereign power related to a federal statute that gives the government that power, that it automatically then becomes a public right. And therefore, the government can bypass the jury trial right. I actually filed a brief in Jarchese and asked the Supreme Court to overrule Atlas Roofing. The majority declined to do so. Instead, what they decided to do is distinguish Atlas Roofing and say that the OSHA Act did not involve the kind of traditional common law actions like involved in this case. In this case, which involved fraud and securities fraud, the court found it was very similar to common law fraud that would have been brought in a common law court at the founding, and therefore was clearly a suit at common law at the time of the founding. They then distinguished the OSHA Act and said that's an entirely separate scheme. It was unrelated to a lot of things that occurred at the founding, and therefore we don't need to deal with Atlas Roofing and its constitutionality right now. Instead, it relied upon two cases, Toll v. United States and Grand Farcia v. Norberg. This was a 1987 and 1989 case. Toll dealt with the Clean Water Act and a fine that was issued. The court there said a fine under the Clean Water Act was very similar to an action in debt at common law, and therefore would fall within the Seventh Amendment. And in Grand Farcia, the court said that a fraudulent conveyance actions are legal in nature and require a jury trial. So it was those cases that the majority primarily relied upon to say that a securities fraud case is similar enough to a suit at common law that it needs to have a jury trial to be able to be functional. And this and often will push the case out of administrative forum. Because administrative forums don't have jury trials, the ability to bring these cases in administrative forum is going to be limited. Instead, a lot of these cases are going to then be brought in Article III courts where they can have jury trials. And these cases really should be in Article III courts where you have a real jury that is going, a real judge that can evaluate these under Article III as well as a jury. I think both of those are true, although this case focused specifically on the right to a jury trial. Now, the dissent primarily focuses on the fact that although the court distinguished Atlas Roofing, according to the dissent, it shouldn't have, that Atlas Roofing really controlled this case. that this case, while the majority said that the remedy at issue, issuing a monetary fine, is what causes this to require a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment, the dissent said, look, Atlas Roofing had a fine just like this one. And it said that the dissent claims that the securities fraud statute is the creation of a new statute, not the same as the common law fraud, because it doesn't require any kind of injury to private parties. It is brought by the government in its sovereign capacity and directly by the government. It's not a litigation between two private parties. Now, I have some, I can see the dissent's point in some ways. I agree that this is not that much different between Atlas Roofing. This is why we asked that Atlas Roofing be overruled. We think that Atlas Roofing was wrong to decide that. The Supreme Court was kind of careful not to say whether Atlas Roofing was rightly decided. In fact, they suggested that Atlas Roofing may already have been overturned, but they don't actually decide that here, which is kind of strange. Usually the court is clear what cases are good law and what cases are it's not good law when it's citing those cases. But the dissent also takes issue with the fact the majority is kind of making that kind of distinction where it says we're going to distinguish Atlas Roofing, but we're not going to say if Atlas Roofing is good law. So I can understand why the dissent is making those claims. I would just say that even if the dissent is right, I think the court should have overruled Atlas Roofing. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions people have on this case.
Great. And this is just a reminder to our audience to submit Q&As through the Q&A feature, but I'll start us off with the ones that we have. So first question we have is, the Department of the Interior utilizes ALJs for various bureaus, including the Bureau of Land Management and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, where no jury trial is available. The individual writes that these ALJs hear things like reviews of lease cancellations or permit denials made by lower level agency officials. What are the implications of this case for DOI?
So I believe Indian Affairs was one of the areas that the majority specified as a kind of public rights area. So I suspect within the Bureau of Indian Affairs, there can be a lot of cases that fall within that kind of public rights doctrine where it can avoid a jury trial. Also, when it deals with certain kind of permit denials or permits, it's hard to say whether those kind of actions will fall within the kind of classic common law legal cases that require jury trials. When you're kind of taking a person's life, liberty, and property, those are the cases that really have to go to Article III courts and really should be decided by a jury. But issues of permit denials may not fall within that. My personal view, at least within the SEC, is that when the SEC bans a person from practicing their profession for the rest of their life, those kind of decisions really should go to jury because you're punishing the person for their wrongdoing. But it's possible that certain permit denials may not fall within that kind of legal distinction and instead may be considered equitable remedies and therefore would not require a jury trial. Lease cancellations may fall within the legal area. At common law, leases in a lot of cases are just contracts. And if you have contracts under common law, most contract cases were decided in courts of law, not courts of equity. But it depends on the it could actually fall within courts of equity. It depends on what the remedy you're seeking is. So if you're just trying to unwind these leases through lease cancellation, that may actually fall within courts of equity. If you're seeking damages under the lease or something like that, that would probably fall into the courts of law. So it depends a lot on what the remedy is that is being sought, whether it would be requiring a jury or not.
Great. And then another question is, would the NLRB fall under the SEC rule or the OSHA rule?
I'm not sure exactly. We'll have to see to future cases. Again, I suspect a lot of this is going to depend on what the remedy is that the NLRB is seeking. If the NLRB is seeking an equitable remedy, for instance, issuing an injunction, or it's trying to do equitable restitution, that's where it isn't taking money to punish individuals. It's just trying to return money to the people that properly should have that money, so that it's trying to set everyone to have the proper and proper property that they already own. Those kind of decisions don't require jury trials. But when you're saying that you did something wrong and we're going to take property being that you properly owned as kind of compensation for that, those kind of remedies where they issue civil penalties, those will have to go to jury trials, I think, in most cases.
Great. And then someone's wondering about disciplinary actions against lawyers and kind of that relation to kind of common law.
So it's possible fines against lawyers for bad actions could be actions in common law, similar to an action in debt. It's also possible that if you're going to disbar an attorney, at least in my opinion, those kind of cases should be considered actions in law, because you're kind of punishing the person by stripping them of their profession for the rest of their life. Those kind of limitations on your liberty for wrongdoing should, at least in my opinion, be cases of common law that require jury trials. But the actual case law on this is still a bit unsettled. I suspect there's going to be future litigation on that.
Great. And then another question is, how narrowly do you think the court will read the public rights exception moving forward? Are civil penalties presumptive common law offenses, or will litigants need to prove that the offense was known to common law?
So the court read the public rights doctrine rather narrowly. Specifically, they read it as applying to specific areas of law: immigration, foreign commerce, taxes. There's specific areas of law that were considered public rights cases, and in those cases, no jury will be required. Outside of those specific areas of law, if the remedy is a financial penalty, a monetary penalty, it's likely the default is going to be that a jury trial is required. If it's some other kind of remedy, an equitable remedy, then there won't be a jury trial.
Very helpful. And then someone's wondering, what are the potential effects on state regulatory agencies with power to fine and on FINRA monetary sanctions?
I'm not sure on how this is going to apply to states. I'm not sure if this aspect of it is going to be properly incorporated against states in that way. It's possible. It could be, but there's aspects of the Seventh Amendment that I think have not been fully incorporated against the states. I believe there's certain like size of juries and things like that that haven't been fully incorporated against the states. And I don't know if this aspect is going to be incorporated against the states. And the second part of that question, what was that again?
Something regarding FINRA.
FINRA. As far as I know, FINRA would apply like any other agency. If the remedy is going to be for a monetary fine, then it would apply. If not, then it won't.
Great. Someone wonders, would jury trials in administrative law cases tend to have different outcomes than similar cases decided by ALJs?
Oh, I think absolutely. We see right now that among the administrative forum, the agencies have upwards of 90%, maybe 95% success rate. These are people that the SEC chooses to appoint and can remove if they aren't deciding cases in SEC's favor often enough. So it's very obvious that these kind of inherent conflicts of interest exist among ALJs in adjudicating these kind of SEC cases. I think a civil jury would be drastically different than ALJs. I think even a federal judge would be drastically different than ALJ, and a civil jury would be even more so than a federal judge.
Someone wonders, which agencies do you think will be the most affected? And they list kind of fines imposed by the EPA and some other groups.
I think EPA is likely to have most of its fines shifted over to a jury trial system. Some places like Social Security Administration are very unlikely to have to go through a jury trial because they're involving the public benefits. They're not taking money from individuals. They're handing out money to individuals. And that makes a very important difference. When government comes in to take your property, it needs to afford you that full due process right in Article 3 with a jury. When it's giving money to others, it doesn't need to go through that full process. It might go through some limited process, but it doesn't necessarily need a jury or an Article 3 court system to do that.
Someone else asks, with respect to the Fifth Circuit's two constitutional holdings that the Supreme Court did not reach, do you consider those to be good law in the Fifth Circuit?
Technically, I believe the Supreme Court has vacated that opinion. So they're not binding law in the Fifth Circuit. But I think anyone bringing a case in the Fifth Circuit is likely to want to point at those and say, at least persuasively, the Fifth Circuit found this, and then it should do so in the future. And the Fifth Circuit, having already made the determination in the past that these are valid claims, is likely to do so again in future cases. So I think they're probably very persuasive authority in the Fifth Circuit, although they may not be binding authority in the Fifth Circuit. Speaking for a moment about those two other decisions that the Fifth Circuit had held, I think there might be some problems with the non-delegation doctrine application here. I'm a very big fan of a strong non-delegation doctrine. I think courts have too often not enforced the non-delegation doctrine in cases when it should be enforced, where the statute says if for the public good or if for the public benefit or some very vague kind of principle, and let agencies and Congress kind of get away with that kind of delegation where it should be enforced in non-delegation more vigorously. However, I think in this case, it's at least plausible to say that this falls within a core executive power, the power to bring cases. And if that's the case, there's no non-delegation problem. Non-delegation only occurs when it's legislative power being handed to the executive with no kind of discretion. To the extent that it's executive power being exercised, there is not a non-delegation problem. So I see that as a big issue in these kind of non-delegation doctrine cases, specific to this kind of non-delegation doctrine, where it involves the choice to bring a case. Now, that doesn't mean that it's entirely wrong. It's just a big hurdle that I think you have to get over when considering how this should properly be applied. As to the removal of the ALJs, I think this is a no-brainer. Free Enterprise Fund made very clear that two layers of for-cause protection is far too much. You need to have one layer and no more than one layer between the president and the officer. And in this case, we're talking like three potential layers, at least two, maybe three, because you have the ALJ, you have the SEC, and then you also have the Merits Protection Board, which has its own for-cause protection layer. So that's way too many. And I suspect it's only a matter of time before the LJs get their removal protection stripped, or the clarification that the SEC and the Merits Protection Board have their protection stripped.
So if someone else wants a little bit more clarification on the jury trial aspect of it, they say they've kind of seen some people suggest that Jarchese requires jury trials in agency civil penalty cases only if there's a fraud claim or other claim with a clear common law analog. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
It does require a clear common law analog. However, if you look at Toll, Toll made clear that any kind of financial penalty is going to be similar to an action in debt at common law. And therefore, any financial penalty is going to be similar to an action at common law. And so I find it very, very likely that any kind of civil penalty is going to be found to be similar to a common law action of some kind. So I think it's going to apply very broadly.
Great. Then someone asks, will DOJ issue guidance that recognizes the applicability of jury rights in civil penalty cases that do not involve the SEC or fraud claims, or will rulings from lower courts that or designed to punish a regulatory violation be necessary?
I don't know what the DOJ is going to do. It might issue guidance. It might not. It might try to fight this in all kinds of different agencies one by one. But I suspect it's going to lose those fights if it tries to do that. So we'll see how far the SEC wants to fight tooth and nail, inch by inch, or if it's just going to accede to the vast majority of these, or try to carve out some kind of, you know, for Indian Affairs and for the and Social Security and for these agencies, it doesn't matter. But for those agencies, it does. We'll have to wait and see what the DOJ does.
And you've touched on this a little bit, but I think some people are still a little bit confused about how Jarchese applies to kind of either state level situations or state admin law. Could you kind of provide just additional guidance there?
So a lot of state level courts kind of follow the federal system in a lot of ways. And so I think it's entirely possible that both state courts will decide to follow this on their own. And then there's the possibility that it will be incorporated against states if people bring challenges for that. I'm not aware of it. You know, this aspect is somewhat new. It's possible that it's not going to be properly incorporated against states, but it might be. I'm not sure on the future of that.
So someone asks a question about OFAC, and does this case potentially mean that OFAC civil enforcement proceedings of economic sanction violations are unconstitutional? And if so, then perhaps some parties will be more emboldened to fight OFAC charges in court?
I'm not familiar exactly with the civil enforcement proceedings in OFAC. So I can't tell you whether it falls within the kind of the public rights doctrine areas, but it might. I'm not sure on that one.
Great. And then so someone said the NLRB recently determined that employers must pay for health insurance premiums of employees who were wrongfully terminated in addition to reinstatement and back pay. Where do equitable remedies functionally become fines?
Now, that is a very good question. So to the extent that the NLRB is issuing an injunction, ordering them to do some kind of future conduct, you know, in the future, you must do this, that is considered usually an equitable remedy. It will not involve juries. To the extent that they're making employers pay restitution to the employees, assuming that it's only that they're making the employer pay what the employer was supposed to have paid all along. That is generally not considered a common law financial penalty. That kind of restitution, where it's only what the NLRB is claiming the employer was supposed to pay all along, probably not going to require a jury trial. You will be able to then appeal that decision, NLRB, to the court. And because it's a pure pure question of law as to what the law is, there's no deference then given to the NLRB's determination of that law. And you'll get an actual Article III judge to be able to tell you what the law is in this case. And that's a big difference between kind of equitable remedies and legal remedies. Legal remedies often involve factual determinations as to what happened in the past, and therefore those factual determinations are binding to a certain extent on the courts above them. The courts will give deference to those factual determinations made by the agency. But in a lot of equitable decisions, because they're only specifying what the law is right now and going forward, those kind of determinations are often done de novo by the appeals court. So you can still get a judicial Article III decision made. Now, when they go to kind of punitive damages, those are legal remedies, and you will get a actual jury trial, or should get a jury trial, for the damage awards that are punitive against the employer in those cases.
Great. And then someone has a question about The Patent Office uses administrative trials that could result in the revocation of a granted patent. Does the fact that the Patent Office is responsible for the original grant mean they can revoke this property at a later time?
So I think there was a recent case on this, like oil states, that discussed the patent system. And the court, including Justice Thomas, described the patent system and the ability to revoke it as the kind of offering of a public grant. It's not private property. It's kind of some type of public grace to have this monopoly for a period of time. And because of that, they did not describe it as a private right, but a public right. And because of that, it would not involve jury trials through the patent system, even to revoke it. It's not my personal opinion. I think the court got it wrong in that case. My case, yes, the granting of the patent would not require a jury trial. But in my opinion, the revoking of the patent is the taking of a private property right at that time and should require a jury trial. But the court disagreed with me in that case. So I doubt any jury trial is going to be required on patents.
And I think someone just was really interested in what you were saying about kind of incorporation and the right to a jury trial, and is wondering if you could just kind of expound on that a little bit more.
So I don't know what the future is going to be on this. I know a lot of the Bill of Rights has been incorporated against the states, but not all of it. There's certain aspects on like size of juries or certain states that do smaller, like six-man juries in certain civil cases. And the federal courts haven't yet required full 12-man juries that would be required in the federal court system under the Bill of Rights. So this may fall within the kind of Bill of Rights that have been incorporated, that will be incorporated against the states and require states to follow this as well for jury trials. It may be more similar to like whether a 12-man or 6-man jury, where it's required at the federal level but not required at the state level. So I can't really say that which way that's going to go in the future.
And someone wonders if CFPB and FTC action seeking civil penalties, if they will be entitled to a jury trial.
I suspect both of those seeking civil penalties are going to require a jury trial, very similar to an action in debt as found in Toll. Any kind of penalty system where you're taking monetary penalties are likely to be in the common law claim that does require a jury trial. Equitable remedies, injunctions, restitution, things like that probably can avoid jury trials.
And then someone wonders, how will this decision affect regulatory agencies who have no in-house administrative judges, such as the FDIC?
Well, as long as they bring their cases in federal court, they're still going to require a jury trial, but they're probably already requiring a jury trial when they bring penalties in federal court.
Great. And then a question about... you could say more about the civil penalties that are associated with employment discrimination.
So again, I think to the extent that they're issuing penalties, they're likely to require jury trials. These are monetary penalties for wrongdoing. It seems it's possible that these cases are far enough away from common law actions that the court might associate them more with OSHA. But this case does seem to be a sea change, where the court is moving away from that kind of OSHA decision in Atlas Roofing. I would not be surprised if Atlas Roofing gets overturned in the future, and this is a step towards that. But you don't know. It's possible that certain kinds of employment cases might be associated to be more like OSHA than it does fraud claims. There's not a lot of employment discrimination cases at common law. So they may say that's just far enough apart, it's distinct and different than the kind of cases that would be brought at common law.
Great. And then last question, will this holding lead to an expansion of Article III courts to handle a large volume of cases?
It's possible that it could, but I mean, if you look at the number of ALJs that are actually being brought forth for these kind of cases, a lot of them had very small number of ALJs. the vast, vast majority of ALJs are in the Social Security Administration, and they're not going to be affected by this decision at all. The SECLA itself had a handful of ALJs at most, and most of the agencies that bring these kind of contested administrative law, they don't have that many ALJs. So while it will increase the number of cases being brought in Article III courts, it's not going to be a large volume, at least in my opinion.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speaker for the benefit of his time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.